Hello and welcome to Scoppy Radio. My name is Dan Johansson.
And I'm Maureen Smith.
And we're joined by the elusive, by the incomparable, the never-ending, Jonathan Hanna.
It seems like that. I am elusive, I guess.
And never-ending.
And never-ending. Yeah. It's definitely like I gotta take a break one day. Yeah. Maybe.
I was just talking about like presence. Like you walk in and you're like, when is it gonna stop? When is it gonna end?
Well, never. Just in the sense of
always
like,
a party. It's a wild party, as per that poster on your wall.
Our weird piano full of people that have given us posters for their events coming up.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. One of these days we're gonna get a cork board.
Yeah. One of these days.
One of these days.
When we can afford a cork board, am I right?
Donate to the show.
Yeah. No, actually, so that's really funny that you mentioned that, because this morning we learned that the audio mixer that I use for recording other people, that is a freelance, that we use for the podcast, that we use for all of everything we do, broke.
Well, one of the inputs broke. One of them is still working.
We're still recording on this one, Mike.
We're all huddled tight around. I mean, it's broke. It needs to be replaced.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, so donate to the show. I'm gonna be writing a weird Facebook post about it later. I'm gonna try really hard to not. We were talking about this, Maureen and I, about like salesman tone. I'm a really bad pitch giver.
Because
an entrepreneur.
Well, yeah. his pitches are all so desperate sounding. Whereas I'm more of like a showman. I'm like, hey, if you appreciate this, if you want to support this, then if you're able, you should do this.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, God,
I'm coming apart of the scene.
Why have you forsaken me?
Please, my family is starving. I budgeted $5,000 for avocado toast. I need a mixer.
Oh, man. You ever seen those memes when they're like, all right, so rent is
$500. Yes.
Electricity is $100. Grocery is $200. Tickets to this festival, $3,000. Can someone in economics help me budget this?
Oh my god. Yeah.
Please, my family's starving.
Yeah. Speaking of never ending, do you know, like, I always imagine whenever I see, like, unaesthetic art memes and for what is it, post-contemporary teens?
Was it, yeah, poorly placed unaesthetic art memes for... Or poorly played. I forget what that page is.
Yeah.
Like, there's like two. I mean, there's the classical contemporary music memes for classical teens.
Yeah.
And then there's the poor and or unaesthetic art memes for placeholder teens. Yes. That's what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I love those memes, first off. And the other thing is that I will say, and this is like, I hope this is the biggest compliment that I can give you, is that whenever I'm talking to normie music folks, I always think of whenever I'm like, oh, have you ever heard of this meme page? And they're like, what? And I'm like, yeah, they like make a lot of jokes about Boulez and like all like, and like other obscure. And they're like, no, you're talking about. And I'm just like, Jonathan Hanna would be rolling in his grave right now.
I would.
Rolling in his grave.
It's all about
those
memes.
Grave.
Yes, I'm currently in a grave, actually.
Yeah.
I've become a vampire since we met. So it actually is the never ending and the elusive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So now I'm a vampire.
Yeah.
For placeholder teens.
For never ending elusive
did
vampire.
Did you see that the profile pic that was going around though? Actually, I'm pretty sure it was the placeholder teens. They recently just put a thing where you can now make anything a G. Shermer edition.
No,
it's great. Check it out.
That's
the other
really
thing
cool.
though is like they did one of those like hold your profile pic for a week things, like the little like stickers or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and it's like, I know there are no jobs in classical music. Stop, please. Or was that? What was
oh,
it?
Oh yeah.
I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I know that there are no jobs in music. Please stop telling me.
Yeah, that's what it is. A little smiley face emoji.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which coincided perfectly because it's like my engagement photo, and the smiley is on Suzanne's face.
Perfect.
Love you, honey.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've known Jonathan for like 4 years?
Yeah, it's been a while, hasn't
it? I remember, like...
since we started grad school.
Yeah, I just remember that you were, like, the music theory TA, and you would always be, also always be in the library. I think I was writing for the paper at the time, and so I'd be in the library a lot.
Yeah, I hung out in the library a lot. Did I ever tell you that, I probably shouldn't do names, right? Or, well, like, you know, the librarian, Anita, like...
Oh, yeah,
she
yeah.
offered me a job at the... at the library, because really? I was there so much and I knew the stacks really well.
Yeah.
And so I would always just be hanging out there, and like one time she just came up to me and was like, hey, can you like work here? You're more competent than like 99% of my workforce.
That's so good.
I didn't take the job because I had enough going on, yeah. But I was like really flattered. I was like, aw.
So was it, what,
because I love libraries and I love the Dewey Decimal System.
Yeah. So. They had a good, I liked that library. I love that.
Oh, it's great. It's actually, yeah. It's, I mean, it's much better than DePaul's music library, mm-hmm. since I did DePaul and Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
I don't...
Yeah, you're a Chicagoan musician through and through, like, as far as, like, if being a musician of a different of a city depends on going to most of their music schools.
I'm applying for PhDs this year.
Cool.
Northwestern U of Chicago, because that's all that's hot, that nice. There is for the PhD, so.
Nice. I love U of Chicago. I was working there so for, we'll like, not truly there, but, like...
for one of their former deans.
Yeah,
you for like a year.
Really cool. What do you want to do?
Composition. I'll go into that. Susanna is always like, you should teach a class though, or you could become a professor in like contemporary technique for piano. And mm-hmm. I'm like, well, that sounds cool too.
Yeah.
But and now I'm like thinking about it. I was like, that would be fun.
Well, it's kind of seemed like, but Stephen Yule has like taken a piano extended techniques course from you.
I have sat down with Stephen. Yeah. Yeah, he's always like, can we look at this score? I'm like, yeah, let's meet up.
Yeah.
Let's do it. Yeah, no. Yeah. Oh my god, I love Stephen though. That mm-hmm. man can play anything.
So did yeah. he was he on anything this weekend?
No, it was actually me playing. Right, it was my performances. Right. So this weekend I did, Ursa Ensemble opened up their season,
mm-hmm.
At the Ravenswood Art Walk this weekend. We played, a new work written for us by Jeff Kolkalski, who's a Chicago composer, and we did Quartet for the End of Time.
Very cool.
So we hit the road running.
Do you mind telling everybody about Ursa Ensemble? Because I think it's something that not a lot of folks know about.
So Ursa Ensemble... I joined the group, 20, let me remind myself how to do this right, it's been a while now. I believe I joined the group 2013, because it was like mm-hmm. around the time that I started grad school, and the first piece I played with them was the Brahms Horn Trio.
Mm-hmm.
And never have I like had such a heart attack learning that part. But we did, so I joined the group. We are made up right now of a violin, viola, cello, clarinet, and... piano. And it's Rachel Brown's the artistic director, Veronica Nettles on cello, Nicholas Jeffrey viola, Joe Sanchez, who everybody knows I think or has heard of at some point, and me. But we used to be a larger ensemble, but we've downsized for the mm-hmm. time being, and we do a lot of things. We do a thing called collaboration and concert, where we work with writers, artists, dancers, whoever wants to work with an ensemble and create another and help an audience, like, participate in a more, I guess, wide array instead of just, like, viewing a classical music concert. It's like, mm-hmm. We'll have an artist come in, and they'll be like, okay, we're going to work on this piece, and we're going to talk about lines or, like, some kind of expressive use of, like, art that's easy to do for an audience if they don't have, like, technique coloring or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But, like... we bring in the artist and they give like an art lesson, and then we play music, and then people draw their art that they feel to the music. So that's one of our things that we do with collaboration and concert. And then yesterday we had a silent auction for some of the art that we've had in the past, and there's some incredible stuff that we've had from our shows. Yeah. So check out ursaensemble.com. I'm fairly positive that's it.
That's really cool. I did this thing in Milwaukee where I... would go into schools that didn't have music programs and do like a couple like prep lessons with kids before they went to a piano recital that we put on for them. And one of the things that I did was I would put on music and I had them draw to it.
Yeah,
and
it was great.
It was so cool.
And I think what's so wonderful about it is it's a lot of people sometimes feel when they listen to music that they're not like maybe like smart enough, or they don't get it, or like they mm-hmm. don't know how to interpret music, or they feel mm-hmm. they don't know. But it's like, if you're an easy way to kind of like show them that they're clearly aware of like what they're listening to is just give them a pen and paper and let them just kind of draw what they're listening to. And like that's it gives them a visual representation of like, oh, you are clearly like aware of lines and timbre and other aspects of music that you weren't really sure of before. And it's like there's no one's to say like someone's better at listening to music than someone else. It's yeah. stupid and subjective and
yeah.
like, yeah, it doesn't help anybody. So, but yeah, like that's something that we've also had like a poet come in and people wrote poetry while like listening to, I can't remember what program we did that, but we did it at an art museum.
Cool.
So, yeah.
Yeah, perceptive listening is a really interesting, you know, there could be entire classes, obviously, which y'all do, about it. Just like, kind of, I mean, with like some, with a little bit of guidance, it can be so, so cool. Like, okay, you know, you want, like, staccato is this, legato is this, and... Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, like, and then, like, you'd be like, oh, if you hear a staccato passage, you could do, like, little dots, or yeah. hear a legato, mm-hmm. do a line. And it's like, okay, that if you give them even just that basic fundamental, like, thing to work off of, they create crazy shit. It's awesome.
And is it mostly with adults?
With adults, and we've done outreach at schools. We've brought in an artist, and we had, like, we did a whole gym worth of kids once.
Oh my god.
And we did classical music and new music. We do a lot of commission work and stuff. So this year we have two commissions. Well, we have three commissions. Jeff Kolakowski, Jordan Jenkins, who I think you guys have heard of, another composer mm-hmm. in Chicago. And I wrote something for the group this year.
Cool.
So we'll have we have three big programs upcoming with all those. So we have our Quartet for the End of Time, Kolakowski collab. We're playing at the Green Mill in October next. That'll be our next concert. We'll be doing, with my piece, we're pairing the Bartok Contrasts and the Bartok Violin Sonata, so I'm going to be having another heart attack learning Good. That part. And then there with Jordan's, we're doing the Beethoven Eyeglass Duo, Stravinsky's Soldier Tale, his piece, and there was one other piece, but I can't recall. I think Ludus Foski. But it's going to be a really, really fun season, and I highly recommend checking out what we're going to be up to next. And awesome. I know we have a collaboration in concert in October or November as well. So that's what we have, at least in the short term,
mm-hmm.
for the time being. But yeah, I've been playing with them for quite a while, and I mean, like, it helped me, like, immensely as a pianist. Like, I mm-hmm. love collaboration, and I love working with other musicians and performing piano that way. With solo music, it's mostly I focus myself in contemporary music. No one needs to hear me play Beethoven. There are people who are way better at that. But I play Beethoven in a chamber setting, and I very much enjoy it.
Cool.
Can't you hear the throngs of fans screaming for you to play Beethoven?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. They're all outside right now, our window here. Yeah. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. like...
We're just, like, really good at
play
sound
that
editing.
Pathetique.
Yeah.
That C minor chord at the beginning gets me every fucking time.
Mm-hmm.
I had to do a complete chordal and formal analysis of the pathetique for sophomore year theory.
That sounds about right.
And I wanted to jump off a bridge, and then I had to write like a 7-page paper about it. And I was like, why can't I do one or the other? Because and they were like, due on the same day, of course. So it was a complete chordal and formal analysis of the pathetique, and also a 7-page paper.
That's a lot of fun.
And I did nothing else.
For me, anytime I hear the pathetique now, I always think of Gould's performance of it. And if they don't play that one like turn thing without like feeling like they're just like ripping off a Band-Aid, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when people are like really just rubato the shit out of it, I'm like, no.
Glenn Gould playing Beethoven is such an interesting thing, too. Yeah. Have you heard his Moonlight recording?
Yes.
That shit's mm-hmm. crazy. I think he holds the record for the fastest of the third movements.
Yeah.
Like, I think he clocked in at 4.5 minutes.
It's
something ridiculous. I loved it. I mean, it was hilarious. Like, there's something to say that's like, it's like, obviously, like, it's like not too practice, so purists are like probably pissed off. Mm-hmm. But like, it's so crazy to just watch. It's exciting. It really is exciting to watch, regardless if someone agrees with it.
Right, and like he at the paces that he goes, he can fit like 3 sonatas on a CD, like in an 80-minute period. I'm like with room, I think.
His Mozart sonatas are hilarious. Mm. Those, I would say, the one thing like with Golden Mozart, it's like one of the more intriguing. Like, this probably should never have been paired, but he did it anyway.
Yeah.
God. Like he plays the first 6 sonatas like 20 clicks faster, like of everything.
I love Glenn Gould.
Yeah.
His Schoenberg and Webern interpretations are incredible.
Yeah.
The Webern variations. That's a video of him doing it on YouTube.
Something I want to get into. Up. Yeah.
Ooh, that might be like...
Our next listen.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I really love... I love his well-tempered clavier, too.
Oh, and also...
Oh, his Bach.
That's what... Have you heard the... Okay, so with... I got a few things about Gold. Anyway, First off... Have you heard the Leonard Bernstein and Glenn Gould recording of the first keyboard concerto, the D minor one? Da 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 dun 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 da 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 da. That one? It's like a rock concert. It is so good.
I've seen that that Leonard Bernstein's like he had that like NBC
lecture
show.
Series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where he like brought Glenn. He's like, and here's this like young talent, Glenn Gould. And he's like, and like a clearly very nervous Glenn Gould is like, okay, and then like just rocked everyone.
That sounds about right. I mean, he didn't talking with people. He was not a. Pretty sure he was on the spectrum, but
oh yeah,
like, wow, for sure.
He like talked. Like, there's a thing on like YouTube of him like walking around the zoo and he just talks with the animals. Like,
yeah.
It's, yeah, like, he clearly was just very zoned in on his thing and not talking with people.
Yeah.
I would very gladly be on the other side of a Glenn Gould phone call. Like, if you're... I read that book, Daily Rituals, actually, it's right there. And it's just about different artists and their weird, like...
Habits.
You know, habits. Because all of them have
so
weird stuff. And his was that he'd just, like, sit on a piano bench that his uncle made. Well, that was what he always played
That's
on.
That's what he always played on.
But he would, like, be... He would sit on it at like 4 a.m. at his piano and just kind of like play notes different ways and call people and be like, how does that sound? Like through the phone. Okay, how about that?
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was the other thing? Listen to that Glenn Gould Leonard Bernstein collab. It's the best recording, I think, of that keyboard concerto.
It's the Bach D minor?
Bach D minor. It's the number one. Yeah, number one D minor.
Okay.
Glenn Gould, Leonard Bernstein. And I forgot I think it's the New York.
Okay.
I can't remember off the top of my head. But there's a video on YouTube of it, too. And it's on Spotify. And then on YouTube that I do know it's there now, it came from The Art of Piano. He did his own... he did his own transcription of the Ravel La Valse. For solo piano.
Oh, cool.
Because Ravel did his own transcriptions for 2 pianos and for 1 piano of that piece, but the Glenn Gould transcription, or Glenn Gould's transcription, is better than Ravel's transcription in my book. It is awesome. It is fire, like fire emoji, 100 lit.
Well, I always see it.
But it's really fire fucking cool. 100. And it's a video on YouTube, so you can watch his hands, and it's just like, you're a freak.
Mm-hmm. Honestly, that is one of my favorite things to do with musicians, because I come from a, my instrumental, I'm far from an expert, but abilities come from, like, a folk tradition, and so, like, I'm most comfortable in, like an Irish-style session where like I'm watching a guitarist's fingers move around chords, and then I'm transposing them onto my ukulele and just like playing along. Cool. And so for me, watching people's hands is so like deeply satisfying for me, because it's how like I pick up things faster watching people's hands than I do like reading chords.
Oh, huh, that's cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool.
It's cool.
So you should learn sign language too while you're at it.
I should. Mm-hmm. Sign language is so cool.
Awesome.
I have a cousin who's a sign language interpreter.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I really wish that this were a video podcast just for that moment of
where I couldn't think of a word, and I
have pretended. Italian in my heritage, so yeah. I just flopped my hands around for those listeners.
Podcast goals.
This is my last tangential thing.
No,
on please. Glenn Gould. This is the dumbest thing I ever did. But so when I was in high school, and you're so easily like swayed by things that you love in high school. So I loved Glenn Gould so much that I chopped the stool of my piano bench so that it could be lower so I could play as low as he did. Worst idea ever, by the way. Terrible. Don't ever do that. It's terrible for your back.
How long did you play like that for?
Maybe, probably at maybe 2 years. Probably, let's give it a year.
2 years? Yeah,
when I played with the, well, funny enough, I played with the Hartford Symphony. I won a concerto competition in like high school, and I played the St. Saëns Piano Concerto, and like I had crazy hair, and I sat really low at the piano, and I played this fucking concerto with the symphony orchestra, and I'm like, I must look like an insane person now that I look back on it.
They love that.
Playing like Glenn Gould.
Playing like Glenn Gould.
With crazy hair.
Yeah. Mm. But that was then you're like, your teacher's like, that is stupid. You're stupid. Sit upright. And now I actually sit really high at the piano. I have more control, I feel, when I have the keys like laid out a little bit below me. So it's not like this middle ground. I kind of like to sit further up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's
no,
that's my Glenn Gould stuff.
I was really glad you said that because do you wish that... I'm going to transition to toy piano talk.
Yeah.
Do you find that it's better to be sitting lower or higher when playing toy piano?
Let's see. I don't think I've quite found the right, like, that's what I need to do, like, this year before I go to Florida, is find a stool that sits well with me on a toy piano. I my little Redstone Hut, I think I do, like, Indian... I just like sit Indian cross leg play that way, and then and so I would do that, and then also is that like it's just like never mind. I'll talk to you guys after. But I typically try to find like a little bench that I can kind of like sit down low enough, but also not like be like a bum on like the floor.
Yeah,
like I gotta find like a nice like mid ground bench to like sit my butt on. But with my Schoenhut, I have my taller Schoenhut.
Yeah.
That one I can sit in, like, let's say this chair would be fine. And I could be okay with that.
And then what's the optimal positioning for playing toy piano? Is it, like, kind of, like, pseudo-straddling it? Where, like, it's kind of, like, between your legs? Or is it,
like... I definitely would, like, go like that. Because I need as much... momentum on my arms, and you don't need a lot of like space since it's such a small little thing.
Yeah,
but yeah, so I totally
had his man spread the fuck out of it. Man spread, and then his hands kind of down all the way though. Like as I've seen, like when I was doing the videos, I remember that they're pretty straight the arms.
I need to get a better layout for my piano. Mm. So it's been kind of just grungy, like just make it work for the time being.
But it lends itself. I'm curious, and this is what I'm gonna want to check back in with you about after the festival.
This is also the only time I ever man spread is when I play toy piano. Spread that patriarchy.
That's good. Yeah. That's good of you.
It's the time to do it.
That's when masculinity is. It's at its most fragile.
Yeah. I'm curious how grungy the International Toy Piano Festival is going
to
be.
I have no idea what to expect.
Taking it very, very serious. Not that it shouldn't be. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't
know what's going to happen. I mean, it seems like... I mean, like, this festival's been running for... since 2015, I believe. Mm-hmm. So this is their second or third year. I think this is the third year they're doing it, because we're going in 2018 at the beginning of January. And funny enough, I have ever since my friends discovered it, like I have some friends who found it when it first started this festival, that they would always message me on Facebook and be like, you should apply for this. And I was like, I just never did it. I always laughed at it. I was like, oh, this is so funny. I was like, I always wanted to, But then finally, so like Plucky Plunkers gets started this year. We're like, oh, we should actually like apply. Mm-hmm. Like this might actually be hilarious and in like a good way. It's kind of, I think these guys have some really like good funding. I wonder if the director's gonna listen to this. She friended me on Facebook, Elizabeth cool. Baker, but who I'm really excited to meet now. But yeah, it seems like they really have like their shit together down there.
Yeah.
So what?
But we're gonna be on the Boyd Hill Nature Preserve. With three other ensembles in residence.
Where in Florida is it?
I believe it's near Tampa or okay. St. Petersburg. I checked and the drive is like 17 hours or something like that from
yeah,
Chicago
that's probably
to there.
More
and we're
in, yeah.
probably going to drive because the commissions that we did for our project is... they're focused on our toy pianos and
right.
our tech that we have, so... It would, some of these pianos, actually the piece that I wrote, so the how do I get this damn music box working, has to be done on these toy pianos.
Yeah.
So it is hilariously selective.
Yeah.
But,
That is the story that I always love telling. I have like three tangents that I'm going to keep going on.
We're going on a lot of tangents
about
already.
This piano.
We make Glenn Gold.
Do you remember when I got this piano?
Wasn't that for the new music brew?
The new brew
was
thing?
That's the piano right there.
Yeah,
I remember I bashed that thing.
I like begged Jonathan to write some music for this thing that I was producing, and so he did, and we performed it together, but it specifically needed, they wanted to use an electric piano, and I was like, no, it specifically needed an acoustic.
Oh, yeah.
And we found this out about... I found out about the fact that they wanted to use an electric, that the space didn't have an acoustic, like, the day of. And I was like, that's not going to happen. And so I went on Craigslist, and I emailed 30 or 40 different people in the free piano listings, and heard back from about 10, had it narrowed down to about 2 in different suburbs, and I was gonna go rent a U-Haul, and then the last minute at like 3 o'clock for a 6 o'clock like setup, a woman emailed me from Logan Square, and that's where I got. We rented a U-Haul, picked this piano up, brought it to the venue, performed with it. Brought it back to the apartment.
Got yelled at by a cranky old man who wanted us to cut the shit with the noise.
Yeah.
Which was really funny.
At the event that we
at
were hosting.
At the event that we...
And illegally parked a U-Haul after that. Not me, someone else. But, like, it was a weird,
That was a crazy night.
Yeah.
It really was. So, anyway, what else with the toy piano stuff? Also, thank God that, like, we are, so we just got listed on the International Toy Piano Facebook page today, so you can type in, I'll look it up, but, we were listed, and our picture is the one of us performing at the Nightcap on the 4th of July, America Series.
Nice.
So, which is really exciting. Yeah, it's on the, if you go with the New Music Conflagration is the organization that sponsors this in
cool.
Florida, and Elizabeth Baker's the director. But yeah, we got our little congratulations today, and then if you go to the site, you can, all the listeners can just imagine me waiting for a phone to load.
Mm-hmm.
It's exciting.
Well, as that happens, I want to shout out Kelly Sheehan.
Oh, yeah.
Who we haven't talked about yet, but she's fantastic.
Boom. Oh my God. God. She's wonderful.
That photo came out great.
Yeah, it's a good photo. And
yeah.
It, like, I have like two dinosaurs hugging on my t-shirt. Mm-hmm. She's got like what looks to be a potato and a
yeah.
skull. It's awesome.
And I love what what you two working together does really well. Like, I like that because she has such an electroacoustic focus, and you have such a like, let's do weird shit focus. In the best possible way.
Oh,
but I like the energy together.
The combination has worked quite well, and it's been mm-hmm. it's been so much wonderful working together.
Yeah.
It's like we both are like we like the same thing, but like in very different ways, which
yeah.
then like branches out the group's like overall focus and potential for music.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been really, really a good time.
Yeah.
And then what was I going to... Yeah, and if you... Our bio is hilarious. You should read the bio. If
Definitely.
You haven't read the bio.
Cool.
But, follow...
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
So, no, you go.
No, Noise Bias just turned 1 today.
That's right. Happy birthday to Noise Bias.
Happy birthday, Noise Bias.
They're doing it.
Yeah.
Noise
they're
Bias?
Doing it.
Noise Bias is great.
Oh, they're the best.
Yeah.
Yeah. We hosted them after the, after the 4th of July concert, and that was honestly one of... You were there.
I was there, obviously. Yeah.
Yeah, and that was honestly one of my favorite Scoppy sessions.
Yeah.
Just because it was, like, it was like a medium-sized crowd. Like, there were enough people involved that the audience participation stuff wasn't weird. Mm-hmm. And it was just, like, we had, like, a cool lady conversation afterward that is lost to time.
Aww.
Donate to the show. I'd love to live in a world where everything that we do, when we do a like thing history. Like that.
I'm kidding. Yeah. It just got lost.
Because we just need, lost. Like, all of a sudden. We need, like, lapel mics, you know?
I found a lapel mic system for, like, $115 on eBay.
Mm-hmm.
I might just buy that. I'm getting paid Friday.
Nice.
Cool.
I gotta buy some guitar pedals.
Yeah.
I'm expanding on my toy piano piece that I wrote for the festival. Yeah. I'm gonna use guitar pedals and some contact mics and stuff. Cool. So the little like metal brackets or the little metal what are they called? Oh my god, I'm so bad at this. Like little bars that you hit to make the sound happen on a toy piano.
Mm.
I guess the metal bar. The metal bar. Well, I don't know if there's a term for this.
Yeah, no, I don't.
Fuck me. But,
says the person about to go to the toy piano festival.
But I'm going to contact mic the low metal bars because they're longer than the frame itself, so they stick out so I can get to them.
That's
and I'm
cool.
going to put a contact mic on it. And like I'm going to build the piece on that now.
That's awesome. I'm really curious to hear that.
It'll still probably be a handwritten scar.
Yeah.
Because I'm too lazy to put it into a computer at the moment.
Mm.
But that's like my first little theatrical piece.
Yeah. So as a person who, like a lot of people that we know have like, especially with music and writing music and like, I feel like we're in the middle of this change from like analog pen and paper to like, everything's getting put into like some kind of Sibelius, Finelli, even Logic, even Pro Tools or whatever. I like took so long figuring out that setup that I kind of forgot what the question was.
Was it something about like why do you write hand? Like write?
Do you
hand?
Prefer one over the other? Like yeah.
So what I do is I. Sorry.
No.
I get lost sometimes in my... I handwrite all my scores.
Mm.
So I do... when I do a new piece, I will normally sit down with pencil, a ruler, and my staff paper, and like three notebooks with sketches all over them. And so... Because I can never like write in one notebook and keep it easy. But I do have like... I love those Moleskines with the little staffs on them.
Mm.
So I write all my ideas on that, write what I need to do. And then I have a bigger sketchbook that I use to map out the time space ratios and like other little structural details. And so I use the bigger notebook to like put down all my ideas and the sounds I want to utilize in a piece. And then so using those two, I then take that to staff paper and I write normally once I have like a basic structural foundation of a piece, I normally just kind of go. I don't do too much back editing, or I'll write the piece out essentially from start to finish.
Mm-hmm.
I don't start pieces like in middle points or whatever. I just kind of do the thing and then it's like done. And I write very quickly. If I have an idea that I'm really like interested in, I'll just go ahead and just like kind of plug it out in like 2-3 days or something like that. But it takes me forever to come up with the idea. So, like, normally there'll be, like, a grace period of a month or so. Like, what am I going to do? I'm currently finishing up an alto sax piece, actually, for Richard Brazil, a saxophonist in the city. I'm really excited about. But it took me forever to find the inspiration for the text and everything like that. Mm. And what I ended up deciding on was, okay, I have to obviously know this name, and it kills me inside. Edna St. Vincent Millay, I believe. She is a 1920s like polyamorous like feminist who wrote like really beautiful like poetry and like obvious and like focused on a lot of different things, but also like her sexuality and things like that. And like I found this great little text called "My Candle Burns at Both Ends," and I was like, it was just a four little line thing called Fig Number One, and I was like, done. I just needed those four lines of text to like have the piece like laid out. Yeah, and I was like, I finally found it, and I was like, oh my god! And then I told Richard, because he's like, I want to like exploit in a way, or he's like, I want to like explore like sexualization of the saxophone because of already the connotations of its historical placement in history and what it did in jazz music and stuff like that. So like we're like, okay, we talked about what we wanted to do. I found a poem that like kind of works for me. He does some interesting things in that piece. It'll be premiered in October.
Cool.
But
Is that generally what you do with even like with instrumental pieces, is that you'll find like text to kind of inspire you?
Yeah, it'll be text. It could be a painting. It can be. Yeah, it really can just kind of be anything. But I'd say that visual art and landscape and like landscapes really drove the first start of my like really focused writing after grad school. And then it started getting more into taking from other musical composers. So like I got really obsessed with Hildegard von Bingen. So the alto flute piece that I have for Suzanne, and then my recent civic orchestra piece also focused on Hildegard von Bingen and using her morality play, and then taking bits and pieces of her Gregorian chant and implementing those to create pitch material for the piece and other things. So I'm really, really into medieval music and like monophony, and then utilizing that to create polyphony and other things in my music lately. And then also text. So like it really like it's been kind of a multi, like anything can kind of fly at this point, but it really depends on like who I talk with and they're like, what are you feeling? And then conversation, then I'll start poking around and like seeing what kind of hits me to do the right thing. And then also the instrument is thought about. So if saxophone, I'm like, okay, we sit down, we go over all these techniques that you can do on a saxophone, and let me know if I'm like getting off tangent here.
No,
so with the saxophone piece for the example. And then this will also then lead to my final like answer about Sibelius and stuff like that.
No.
I'm getting there. But,
yeah,
no,
I believe you, yeah.
But so then we sit down and we're like, can you do this? Can you do that? What's it like when you do just an air sound? Can you flutter tongue the air sound? What's that if you do a low key, do a high key, air sound, all these things. Like I really love color and timbre, so I hate thinking about pitch. And so but then I hilariously use it all the time. It's a love-hate relationship. But something that we discovered something that was really, really fun on the saxophone that Richard could do is he would play like this low fundamental. I was like, let's try, can you do like this where you play like a low sound, create a multiphonic, and then single out one of the multiphonics and then keep going with that multiphonic. So you would essentially create like a low fundamental, create a dyad, we'll say, just a dyad, and then he can take that dyad and then just keep going with it. So it was a perfectly looped a transition, and cool. He can circular breathe. So that whole, it's a seamless transition of like this low sound and then high. It's so cool. And so so what worked for me on this piece that I'm finishing up is because of that thing that I was so interested in exploring, like that's what I really used. I use air sounds and I use this multiphonic dyad that he can sift around. And when I found the poem "My Candle Burns at Both Ends," my first thought was the idea of the two candles flickering at both ends, the dyad. And so that lays out the entire piece. So it just goes from like the little idea of like a flickering candle and lighting a candle, and then eventually to the dyad that happens is the two candles lit at both ends. And I don't know if it's gonna make it through the night, but oh my foes and all my friends, it gives a lovely light. It's like the really nice little imagery. So that's like that helped with the piece, like. I was like, and then I wrote it really fast because I was like, it was so clear what had to be done. So I was like, this is easy.
Yeah.
But so then the part that makes me always want to die is because I write all my scores in C because I don't want to transpose. But I wrote this piece out, and I was like, okay, here's everything laid out, great. And then I have to put it in. I do put it into Sibelius so that it's easier to read. I'm fairly pleased with like how like my notation looks when I write. Like when I write like a sentence, it's almost illegible. Mm-hmm. But like if I write notes on a page, very legible. Mm-hmm. And I like care very much about my script when I'm like doing that. But I put it into the computer just for like safety's sake for and making sure it's a very nice, strong edit. Right. And Stacey Garrett kicked my ass like in grad school to be a very good editor and like engraver. So my scores look consistently like clean, and you've seen some of my stuff now, so I think maybe you can like verify it. But
well, I was actually gonna ask if you've spent a lot of time working with autographs, like of other composers' autographs, or like if you've seen them frequently.
There's certain composers like or like editors or like publishers that I'm really interested that I like to see what they do with certain sounds and stuff like that. But like, I like Kaija Sarriaho's stuff, but like, I don't look at their. Yeah, with the autographs, I guess, like, the only composer who I was, like, really into was Ligeti and, like, the way he wrote things. But my, like, notation is so chicken scratch as it is. Like, it's just, like, just that. And so I like, chicken scratch all my quarter notes and stuff like that. But if you do it, like, in a way with, like, the flat of the pencil, you can make a nicer, thicker.
Yeah.
So, like, I've thought about this. It's like, this is fun.
Well, no, that's the thing that's interesting to me is, like, as a person who, for a little while, I was, as a day job, I was doing, like, working with autographs and, like, doing musicology analysis and stuff like that, of, like, trying to figure out what a composer's intentions are. It's always interesting to me the trying to find that moment when the majority of composers realize that their works could be needed to be considered by posterity. You know what I mean by that? And I think, like, it's only gotten more and more as, like, it's just, like, common practice to, like, make sure that you put your... Especially because it's so much easier now to just, like, put something through Sibelius. Like, when, you know, like, 200 years ago, when someone was writing an Italian opera or something like that, like, getting something sent to a publisher was way more involved to get, like, an actual clean copy.
Yeah. Yeah, I self-publish all my stuff, so it's mostly just me and the performer working together and making sure everything is like neat and clean. And normally there's always like a few like edits you have to make after, because like you can't catch everything in a first final draft. So I like caught a lot of things, like with the Civic Project, had to re-edit the whole score, make sure all that was cleaned up. But it does help like to put it onto the computer if you're good at it, because like when you can give a clean score, that shows respect to the performer. And that also shows, like, clearer intentions, less questions to ask. There will always be a question.
Right.
But, like, you can solve a lot of the hardship already. Like, if you look at, like, Luigi Nono scores, which, like, I love all his music, but, like, he handwrote all his scores, and they're almost impossible to read. Like, he'll often do things where it's like it's so high up in the stratosphere and it'll be like one note and he'll just keep doing it and it'll already be in another instrument. It'll be like on another instrument's line. And it'll have like it'll be like violin one super high up there, and then often he'll forget to put enough ledger lines, so the note will change, but it's supposed to be the same note. So it's like stuff like that. It's like it's like kind of silly in the end, like to deal with that. But so that's why I'm like, oh, it's just easier to kind of just make sure it's all nice and clean and prim and, like, it just, I don't know, I prefer it that way. And now I've gotten used to it, so, like, when I get scores to perform, so, like, with the rocking chair series and stuff, I prefer to see, or I like it when I see very clear, easy-to-understand scores, and then I talk with the composer about it, and so, like, there's less questions about, like, why is this the way you did it or whatever, but it's like mapped out very effectively. You can use the index page and be like, I get it all this. Like Kelly Sheehan, really good looking scores, for example.
Nice.
But yeah.
Cool.
Just name drop colleague. But yeah.
Would you mind talking a little bit about the Rocking Chair series?
Yeah. And then I also have to.
We have 5 minutes left. So what was the thing that you wanted?
Let's do the rocking chair series since I was like, since you posted on my wall about that.
Yeah. Well, we don't have to. What was the other thing that you definitely?
With the rocking chair series, it's a project that I've been doing for 2 years now.
Yeah.
And I did the fourth one on Saturday at the Ravenswood Art Walk as well. And there were a lot of people there who weren't like really in the new music scene, and that's kind of my goal, is to showcase new music and experimental music. Really a wide variety of music. It's not just focused on experimental. It like goes all the way to like minimalism, all the way to like performance art. Like, I don't really care, I'll do it. Mm-hmm. So it's like, but I showcase all these composers to kind of, one, broaden a listener's horizons, and two, to really like discuss like why do people choose to write these different kinds of music, what is their focus in life, what drew them to this practice, like why did they choose to do noise music instead of like, you know, minimalism or classical or whatever you want to call it at this point. So I always bring all the composers or most of the composers to these events, and I interview every single one of them about their piece. So I'm like, sit down with a mic and be like, so why did you decide to write a piece on just C and B? A friend of mine, Jesse Diener Bennett, wrote a piece for me where it's just on C and B. And then we talked about it, and it was like really fun, and people really liked it because they understood why he was so obsessed with like C and B. And it was just because of like this like childhood memory of smashing a keyboard. Yeah. But like when you give a listener context on literally anything, I feel that you can, that of someone who may be a little timid to give it a shot will actually open up and experience something that they may not have ever heard before or were like not aware even existed.
Yeah, that makes sense to me because when you first said, oh, it was just written on C and B, I was like part of me was like, whoo, that sounds like it would be like a lot to listen
to.
It's
a pretty brutal piece.
Yeah, but then like given the context of it, I was like, oh, that actually, like, so, you know, in action just now, I just experienced like the benefits of providing context to make a piece more approachable.
And so, and then like I had my first piece ever, I got to one of my first pieces where I ever had to go into the keyboard and do all harmonics on the piano. Luis Fernando Amaya, who wrote the piano piece for me called Condor, I had to use two ebows. Do you know what an ebow is? It's a resonator that it's mostly used for electric guitars, but you can put them inside of a piano and it vibrates the string where it sounds like an electronic like pure wave.
Is it that one of those like metal circular things?
No, it's not. It's like this weird little like black kind of blob, and it's like got a blue light on it, and you place it on a string, and then it just all of a sudden like makes a sound happen, and it sounds like electronics. It is so cool.
Wow.
You guys should come over sometime because I have a baby grand now.
Yeah.
And I'll just show you it on the piano. It's a good time. We'll have drinks over it.
Cool.
Yeah. But he wrote this piece where we use these two ebows, and I had to mark up the entire keyboard for all the harmonics. Mm-hmm. It was like it was a big to do, and then I had to put a sandbag on the pedal. But we talked about the piece, and everyone was like really, really like interested in what was going on there. Kelly Sheehan's piece, it was all about contact miking the score and making noise with guitar pedals and creating music with the piano and the score, and this infatuation with pianists always having to turn pages while they play.
Mm-hmm.
And like people were absolutely open to it afterwards, and they were like, I never knew such a thing could exist. And like because we had that discussion and we opened up that conversation and opened up that world in a non-aggressive or elitist attitude,
mm-hmm.
that most people then are like, oh, this is really fun and awesome, and I really enjoyed like experiencing something that I never thought could exist in like, I guess, in like a musical context.
Yeah.
And then also like Kelly being like, noise and not noise, or like pitch and like noise, there's no difference for me on like music is just the structure of noise. That's the definition of it, right? Like
right.
We take a sound and then we structure. And like I believe the same thing. So, but she said that, and a lot of people were coming up to me as like, I didn't really ever think about that, but they were like really happy to have like heard it. And so this series, I'm like, I'm a gun to like open up that world to listeners that don't really get to see this kind of stuff.
That's cool. And I think that that is honestly what it needs to be happening more, I would say, because I think that that's where we're losing. I think that's where we're losing people.
I mean, that elitist attitude in like academic music and like this like hierarchy that exists, just it doesn't bring new listeners.
And who is it serving?
Well, and I love, that's what I love about, and to bring the conversation full circle, is just like these meme pages that are popping up. Like that is definitely how you radicalize people. And like not even just that, just and politically too. I mean, like I just feel like there's a, it's such a, memeing is such a strong, a powerful way to contextualize something.
Suzanne bought me a book actually on like memes. Like there's like an ed book, and she bought a book from MIT on like the study of memes and how they become like a cultural significance and like how they actually say things in politics and stuff like that. And I'm like, it's, memes are where it's at. But that's the, that's the podcast for today. Research your memes.
Always be memeing.
Always be memes.
Yeah.
I think I. And then, well, we should. I'll one day talk more. We should talk again about the Plucky Plunkers upcoming project for the festival at some point too.
Well,
I know we're out of time. So
no, it's time. We're not like super super strict on time. And there's one more thing that we do with all of our guests. But before I say that, this is just something I'm gonna say generally, because we do such a frequent thing that a frequent show. Like you, and this is something we usually say after we're done recording, but I'm saying it while we're recording because I like also want people to know this because we're always looking for more guests too.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also saying to you specifically, Jonathan, that if you ever want to come back on, please do, because we'd love to have like talk to you more
about this. This has been such a fun conversation. I actually feel like we've only kind of like brushed up on things too. I was like, I want to just keep chatting.
Yeah,
I'm also a chatterbox.
And that's honestly always the best thing, is when people are like willing and open and just kind of like, this
it's so much fun.
Of things that are good. Well, it's easy for us too, because then
less work.
Yeah, right.
I appreciate that you're a chatterbox.
It's fun. Well, on the note of chatterboxing, the last thing we do with all of our guests is a 1-minute plug for anything they have upcoming, or any, or to plug any kind of social media presence they want plugged. It can also be a space to give a shout out to anyone that you think is doing dope work in the city or otherwise, or any kind of self-care stuff that you've been consuming, media, TV, food.
Oh, man.
Yeah, books.
Oh, my God, there's so much.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be a minute. It can be.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. I'll do, first off, because I've been like caps locking all of Plucky Plunkers stuff. Like us, like Plucky Plunkers on Facebook, and like Plucky Plunkers on Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
We have a Twitter account. There's only one tweet on it, and there will only be one tweet on it. So follow us on Twitter if you want to see one tweet. But yeah, we have our Facebook page and our Instagram page. We are absolutely absurdist.
What's the tweet?
Actually, I think we still have to make it. Hold on. I have to text Kelly to make that tweet, but we have a Twitter account now.
Cool.
We're like planning our one tweet. We're like, what are we going to say?
Yeah.
Plucky Plunkers was here.
Yeah.
That's it.
Like, what? Was here.
Yeah. And then, so we do, but we do have an Instagram that I am putting very ambiguous photos of blurry toy pianos. And
cool.
There's one that says our Christmas Hits Volume 1 is going to come out. It will never come out. Also hit up Ursa Ensemble, give us a like on Facebook, give us a like on Instagram. We have a really 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 fun program this upcoming season, and I'm really really excited to be like working with these guys. They're, I don't actually sometimes like, I don't know how the hell I got into this group, because they're all really incredible musicians, and I'm like, oh my god. But Ursa's Ensemble, Ursa Ensemble is going to be a great time. URSA, hit us up. Let's see, what else? Rocking Chair Series will probably return next year with a whole new batch of composers. I did 2 this year and I almost died. So I am not going to, I learned the last program in like a month. Like, I don't have time anymore to like to run it like this. But it's, I'll probably plan on a 5th one with all new composers of Chicago and hopefully around the US and the world eventually.
Cool.
So that's gonna be on its way. I did have a few other things. Hold on. I said Plucky Plunkers. I said Earth Ensemble. I said that. Oh, yeah. My self-help thing. So Suzanne and I actually, so with our jobs and schedules and everything, something that we finally did, and we got this from a good friend of ours, Corbin, actually. Corbin Andrick is also an incredible jazz musician who you should check out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Bonzo Squad, like, next level jazz. Mm-hmm. I love them. They're great. They're wonderful human beings. Anyway, but, so I'll plug them. But, Bonzo Squad. Cool. They play at Arrogant Frog every Wednesday night at 10:30.
Cool.
But the one thing that I've started doing for self-help is Suzanne and I have our Mondays off now entirely from work. Nice. So I have a gig tonight. I'm filling in a sub that I was like, I didn't want to do it, and I was like, I just agreed, because Suzanne ended up also agreeing to a gig that she had forgotten about. Mm-hmm. So it's like, okay, this is our one Monday where we're doing things, but every other Monday after this, we will not take work.
Yeah.
And so Monday is the only day in the week that we actually have a day off. But it actually is wonderful, because then I'm excited to start the week over again and stuff like that. Because I'm a church musician, so Saturdays and Sundays are booked. I teach, I do Old Town School, I accompany, I do all this stuff, so it's like, it's really nice when just that Monday to have to yourself and play some video games and like drink coffee and wake up late. Mm-hmm. And like hang out with the dog and, you know, just kind of relax for a moment.
No, I did the same thing with my work, where I have a permanent request off for Monday mornings.
Well, Sunday nights and Monday mornings.
Sunday, well, I have, yeah, Sunday nights and Monday mornings.
So you have that chunk.
So I have that chunk.
That's great.
It's awesome.
I started it last week, and it has been the most, I mean, just that one day was like, I don't know what to do with myself, because like, I'm normally like 110 miles per hour.
Mm-hmm.
No, just taking even one day, just slow down. Yeah. Is awesome.
So that's been my I guess my like self-help thing that's new, and I'm cooking all my meals at home now, so eating healthier.
Nice.
Yeah, this is so much fun. Thanks.
Yeah,
for
cool. Of course. Yeah, of course.
I'm sure we'll talk more.
Absolutely. Thank you all so much for listening. I've been Dan Johansson.
I continue to be Maureen Smith.
If you want to keep up with what we are up to, there are a lot of ways that you can do that. You can head over to scopymag.com. That's our website. We post all of our articles there. All of our podcast episodes are there as well. And also all of our video recordings are up there. Not all of them, but all of them are up on YouTube. You can get to our YouTube from the website. Anyway, otherwise on social media, you can keep up with us on Facebook under Scopy Magazine. On Instagram, Twitter, Tumblr, Google Play, and iTunes, we are under Scopy Mag, spelled S-C-A-P-I-M-A-G.
And as always, I'm here to emphasize the importance of donations. We run on a shoestring budget. Everything that we've been able to do up to this point has been through your generosity. So first of all, thank you so much. Second of all, we could use a little bit more help. If you're in a position to give, you can head to our website, scopymag.com. Go to our About section. If you are, you can give in one of two ways. You can do a one-time donation. If you choose to do that, you'll have our eternal gratitude, and you'll also get a handwritten thank you note. If you choose to give on a monthly level, there are some cool things. Our next two monthly donors will get a bag of half-wit coffee. We have an ongoing thing that no one has taken advantage of, where if you go back to our interview with Eli Ramirez from Half-Wit Coffee, go to the end of the episode, he gives a clue about his favorite category of flavor notes in coffee, and if you can guess it, then
you
get a free bag of coffee.
Current donors.
Mm-hmm. But if you become a donor, you don't even have to guess anything, you just get a free bag of coffee.
Yeah.
So, and that's for as little as $5 a month. At $10 a month, you get free studio photography from Daniel once a month.
One session a month, yep.
We just finished up a session with Tom Bailey. You get Daniel's photography and photo editing, which is cool. And then
And also a free bag of coffee.
And
a trending theme here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. $25 a month or more, you get space on our website to advertise and a free bag of coffee.
and photography.
And photography, yeah. So
pretty legit.
That's a pretty good deal.
We got to figure out something like we'll cook you dinner if it's $40 a month or more, because we've
every
got that
night, no.
every night, 7 days a week.
Live in shack.
Yeah. Cool. I don't know. We'll figure something out for $40 a month.
Yeah.
Because that's always there.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Elusively leave now.
So give a little, give a lot, and if you can't give, listen, participate, and share.
Cool. Thanks again so much for listening. Go out and make something.
Yep.